and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with growing evidence that the Russian influence attack on the election was more widespread and brazen, with Facebook announcing that they had shut down several hundred accounts created by a Russian company with ties to the Kremlin, who spent $100,000 pushing divisive fake news attacking Hillary Clinton in order to help elect Donald Trump. Dr. Michael Suhlmeier, the director of the cybersecurity project at the Harvard Kennedy School's Belfer Center for Science and International Affairs, who was formerly the director of plans and operations for cyber policy in the Office of the Secretary of Defense, joins us to discuss the warning by Senator Warner, the vice chair of the Senate Intelligence Committee, that Facebook's Russian ads are, quote, just the tip of the iceberg. Then we will speak with Hal Roberts, a fellow at the Berkman Klein Center for Internet and Society at Harvard University, who is the co-author of a new study, Partisanship, Propaganda, and Disinformation, Online Media and the 2016 Election, which documents how, along with Russian interference, highly partisan right-wing sources like Breitbart help shape mainstream press coverage and seize the public's attention in the 18-month period leading up to the election. Then we will speak with Frank Pasquale, professor of law at the University of Maryland and author of The Black Box Society, The Secret Algorithms That Control Money and Information. He joins us to discuss Facebook's decision to get rid of human curation of the news because of bogus Republican charges of bias and the role of Cambridge Analytica's owner, Robert Mercer, and Stephen Bannon in flooding social media with fake news, possibly in collusion with the Russians. Then finally, we will try to make sense of the Oval Office about-face that stunned Republican leaders as President Trump suddenly embraced his new political allies, Chuck and Nancy, as he agreed with the Democrats on a 3-month extension of the debt limit instead of the 18-month extension that McConnell, Ryan, and the Secretary of the Treasury were arguing for. Lawrence Jacobs, the director of the Center for the Study of Politics and Governance at the University of Minnesota's Hubert Humphrey School of Political Affairs, joins us to discuss if there was a savvy strategy here or whether President Trump has gone rogue. And joining us now is Dr. Michael Suhlmeier, who is the director of the Cybersecurity Project at the Harvard Kennedy School's Belfer Center for Science and International Affairs. He currently concluded several years in the Office of the Secretary of Defense, serving most recently as the director of plans and operations for cyber policy. He's also a senior policy advisor to the Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense for cyber policy, where he worked closely with the Joint Staff and Cyber Command on a variety of efforts to counter malicious cyber activity against the United States and the Department of Defense. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dr. Michael Suhlmeier.
Thank you so much, and I'm sorry you had to suffer through such a long bio read.
Well, it's all true, though, right?
Yes, that part is true.
Right. So it does seem like, you know, we can't have do-overs, I guess, in our constitutional system like they are having now in Kenya because of questions about the last election there. But when you combine the recent reports in the New York Times about the extent of Russian hacking into the election systems and into election rolls, and then on top of that, now we've got the minority chair of the Senate Intelligence Committee, Senator Mark Warner, saying that this information that the Russians bought $100,000 worth of ads on Facebook to help Trump and hurt Hillary Clinton in the last election is just the tip of the iceberg. Are these things a part of a big operation? Because that's what the intelligence community's told us very shortly after the elections, that is indeed the case, that this was and I think it was James Comey, the former FBI director, who said it was a very big and concerted deal. So let's start with that, because a lot of people have been suggesting that there's no there with this Russian story, most of all Donald Trump. But clearly, there is something went on, surely.
Well, there's a lot of important points you raise, and I think that the recent revelations that have been reported about this Russian entity buying Facebook ads, there's just another piece of evidence that has come out over the last year, and there will be more clearly. That indicates that Russia had obviously more than just a passing interest in our last presidential election. That should be the understatement of the year. And yet, oddly, there remains a sizable number of people who think that Russia really was either agnostic or had really no interest or nothing to do with it. So at a certain point, the evidence, and I think we're at that point certainly now, and we have been for a while, is sufficient to say that there was a very concerted effort by the Russians to shape the narrative of the discussion here in the United States. And I think on that account, they did succeed in shaping and reinforcing a narrative that suited their interests.
So is there any talk? I mean, are we going to get past the denial that it even happened into, obviously, the Mueller investigation is nowhere over, but at what point are we going to start doing something about this? This, at the end of the day, a foreign actor being able to attack the very nature of American democracy, that's pretty profound, isn't it?
It is profound, and it's very unfortunate, to say the least, that because it has become politicized, therefore there is seemed to be some benefit of denying it. And this is the kind of activity where we should actually all be on the same page, regardless of party, regardless of ideology. It's just not in the American interest to have foreign governments like Russia, which is pursuing interests that are opposed to ours, that are hostile to ours, taking an active role in trying to manipulate the outcomes of our election. So I think there is a core group of people who are going to, no matter what, deny that Russia had anything to do with this. They may be unreachable. But I think there is a growing portion of moderates or people who are just, you know, really starting to learn more and more about what's happening as more and more evidence becomes public, where I think it becomes very difficult to continue saying, well, this didn't happen, and if it did happen, it didn't matter. It's not credible anymore.
So the Russians obviously have invested, at least their intelligence services, the FSB and the SVR, seem to have invested in cyber offense and these troll farms. And the Chinese, of course, have what they call the 50-cent cadre, which are people get paid 50 cents for saying nice things about the government. Obviously, that's something that we can't do in this country and should not do. But how do you counter this idea of that there's this compact between hackers, organized crime, and a foreign intelligence service?
It's a very thorny problem, made even thornier by the fact that the entities that you just described are abusing American platforms. They are abusing platforms like Facebook and Twitter that are U.S. companies. So what you've seen in the reporting over the last day or two is actually a lot of focus on Facebook. And Alex Stamos, who's their chief security officer, had a post on the Facebook website that's worth reading. And what's noteworthy here is we're talking about, as you had rightly pointed out, a very serious foreign interference issue of national security, but we're talking about it in terms of private companies and what private companies are going to continue to do more of to try to prevent this from happening again. Notice that the story is not, you know, where's the military? Where's the Department of Homeland Security? The story is, how is Facebook going to police its own platform? How is Twitter going to police its own platform? That's a shift that probably was not conceivable 10, 15 years ago.
So is this to say then that the Facebook will try and head off any congressional mandates? In other words, Silicon Valley has been largely unregulated. Do you see regulation of Silicon Valley in the future?
Well, that's a very broad it's an important question, but it's very broad in the sense that you don't go to regulation, or I do not think about using regulation as a tool, because it can be a very, very blunt instrument. So on very clear issues of public safety, historically we've shown, the government has shown a willingness to use its regulatory power to try to keep people safe. you know, seat belts, for example, things like that. And I still think there's an opportunity for the government to incentivize change behavior in the private sector. I don't think that regulation and other types of legal authority should be taken off the table, but if you're going to go down that road, it's going to be very difficult. You have to be very careful that you don't stifle the very innovation and creativity that has made these companies and our economy so strong over the last 20 years. But it's clear that something has to change. I just think that right now there's a good opportunity for partnership and doing it collaboratively, that we don't have to wield too heavy of a hand. We don't have to have our government doing that too much.
Well, just in closing, though, it does seem troubling that two-thirds to three-quarters of Americans get their information from Facebook, their news, and a lot of it is from their peers and their friends. So it's not necessarily accurate or objective, and it certainly is what is referred to as reality shopping, where everybody gets their information from their own sources that please them. And so we end up with a country in which there's no consensus about what is true and what is real.
It is certainly a thorny problem for the reasons you've nicely laid out. I would note that this is not the first time historically that the United States has grappled with problems of speech and of platforms and people being able to say whatever they want to say, even if it's not necessarily true. And you know, there's the old adage that the best answer, you know, to the bad speech is just more speech. Not to necessarily restrict it. So that's not going to be your answer all the time, but I think I have some hope that, you know, these platforms, they themselves organically are not producing news, right? They share it, they distribute it, it proliferates. There's still an opportunity here, I think, for us to protect and the integrity of civil discourse, as Stamos said. So my fingers are crossed. We've got a new effort, actually, at the Belfer Center at Harvard to look into this with Facebook and with others to try to help states and help the United States be better for the next election.
Well, Dr. Michael Sulmer, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Thank you. And again, I've been speaking with Dr. Michael Sulmer, who is the director of the Cybersecurity Project at Harvard's Kennedy School's Belfer Center for Science and International Affairs. He was recently the director for plans and operations for cyber policy at the Office of the Secretary of Defense and senior policy advisor to the Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense for Cyber Policy. And joining us now is Hal Roberts, a fellow at the Berkman Klein Center for Internet and Society at Harvard University, who has been the lead researcher for the Berkman Center's reports on Internet surveillance, filtering, circumvention, and distributed denial of service attacks against independent media. He is the co-author of a new report, Partisanship, Propaganda, and Disinformation, Online Media and the 2016 U.S. Presidential Elections. Welcome to Background Briefing. Hal Roberts.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
And what do you make of this remark by Senator Warner, the minority chair of the Senate Intelligence Committee, that the Russian buy of Facebook ads to help Donald Trump and hurt Hillary Clinton during the last elections is only the tip of the iceberg?
So this is certainly alarming, and the data that we see shows that certainly these sorts of Russian hacks and the fake news of this sort of Macedonian type, which is to say either Russian hackers or Macedonian teenagers just making up stuff to put it on Facebook, serve some role in the election and election results. But broadly, the work that we've done shows that there's a more fundamental issue here, which is the asymmetric polarization of the U.S. media system. And what that means is that media sources on the right tend to be influential to the degree that they are very far on the right, and that almost only very far right sites have influence within that media system. Whereas for sites on the left, there's a much more even mix of influence from sites on the left and the center left and the center.
But how does that translate into voting? Obviously, Donald Trump didn't win by, 77,000 votes, but it does seem like his people, Mercer, for example, the billionaire biggest backer of Trump, he had Cambridge Analytica, a company that Stephen Bannon served on the board. It seems like they seem to have the jump on using social media with micro-targeting, et cetera, whereas Hillary Clinton's people tended to be old-fashioned, putting out TV ads in the traditional way.
So first I should say that what we have direct visibility on is the influence of media stories. So that's mostly what we can speak about. We don't have, and I don't think anybody really has, good direct visibility or data on, for instance, direct ad buys or even these Facebook ad buys. Only Facebook has that data to really know what's going on there, as indicated by this recent release of information about these Russian ad buys. But what we do see is we can measure the influence of particular stories online. So we can measure the influence of, say, a story on Breitbart, or a story on some fake news site that has been shared on Facebook, or a story on the New York Times. And what we find is we see some of these fake news stories that there's been a lot of press about, or these sort of Russian-created stories. We see them in our data, and they have some influence. So in our set of 2 million stories, the most influential on Facebook fake news story ranked around, I think, number 55 in influence. So that's pretty influential in a set of 2 million stories and for such an important event as a national election. But it's number 55. It's not number 1 or, you know, number 8. And there's only maybe, there were only 2 of those fake news stories when we looked in the top 100 stories. What we find more broadly is 2 major drivers that we think were much more important. One is that if you look at just at the topics of coverage of the candidates, first of all, virtually all of the coverage of both candidates was negative, which is pretty typical. This election was even more negative than most, but generally stories written about candidates in the press are generally negative. Trump got much more attention because he was doing more attention-seeking behaviors. So so there's more negative coverage of Trump in absolute numbers, but as a proportion, they're about the same. They're both about 95% negative. But when we look at the topics of that coverage, for Clinton, virtually all of the coverage of Clinton was focused on her scandals. It was mostly emails with some Clinton Foundation and early on some Benghazi stories. For Trump, most of his even scandal coverage was related to his issues. And then there was a lot of specific issue coverage, too, which was generally covered negatively. So, for instance, his treatment of immigrants. Most of the media coverage of those stories portrayed his immigration policies and immigration statements negatively, for instance, his statement about Mexicans being rapists. But nonetheless, the issue that's most important to Trump. And the result is that what voters knew about Clinton was she's involved in these email and foundation story scandals. What they know about Clinton, he's involved in some scandals, but he really cares about immigration and, to a lesser degree, jobs and trade. So we think that was a really large driver, is there was simply virtually no issue coverage of Clinton at all. Secondly, what we see in our data is that when we look at the influence of these stories, virtually all of the influence, when we measure by either incoming web links or Facebook shares of stories, so we for a given story, we know how many times it was shared on Facebook, or Twitter shares, almost all of that influence is pushed way over to the far right. So almost only the very far right sites are having any influence on the right. Whereas on the left, again, what we see is a much more normal a much more even distribution of influence, where there's a range of different sites from the left all the way through the center that are having roughly equal amounts of influence. And what that represents is that there's a sort of conversation there from the far left sites that are actively having with mainstream media that is just not happening on the right. And what that allows is for stories that are not made up fake news stories in the sense of a sort of Russian hack, but are nonetheless fake or nonetheless not traced, are getting circulated on the right without any corrective mechanism, because they're not hooked into these traditional institution and norms of journalism.
Well, just in the last couple of minutes, though, is there any possibility of ever establishing a national consensus on what is true and what is real? Are we just so polarized in these alternative realities and alternative facts, as Kellyanne Conway described them, on the left and the right? I mean, I think it's fair to say, isn't it, in general, that Donald Trump's supporters are immune to facts and evidence, and he's certainly not getting a lot of good coverage, but it's not affecting his people.
So there's good news and there's bad news. So the bad news is what I just described to you, which is that there's this highly insulated right, and there's no corrective mechanism within that media system, which is a media system as a large amount of influence for Trump voters or conservative voters. There is a little bit of a hopeful tale, which is that we have, in addition to this overall influence data, we do specific case studies to understand how some of these stories circulate. And what we actually see is we see a lot of effort on the right to feed their stories back into the mainstream media, which had a very detrimental effect in this election, because they were able to successfully, through concerted effort, feed stories about emails or about the Clinton Foundation into the mainstream media and get the mainstream media to pick these stories up. So in a sense, that's bad news, because it's sort of a conduit that's just feeding this stuff that's generated in this right wing into the journalistic institutions. The good news is they evidently see, and we see at least from our audience data, so when you just look at how many people read a given source, that these mainstream media sources like the New York Times and Washington Post are still very influential and still play a very important role. We think that that role was not played very well in this election because they were in a sense hacked, not in the sense of broken into, but in the sense of the system of journalism was taken advantage of by being fed these stories that are sort of circulating in this other sphere. But that does provide some hope that if those journalists can learn how to do journalism in the age where they know that there's this propaganda sphere that's trying to hack them from the right, but also likely, as the left sees that successful, also from the left, will learn ways to cope with that and use their influence more productively toward finding the truth among all the propaganda.
Well, Hal Roberts, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Okay, thank you so much.
I appreciate it. Thank you. And I've been speaking with Hal Roberts, who's a fellow at the Berkman Klein Center for Internet and Society at Harvard University, who has been the lead researcher for the Berkman Center reports on internet surveillance, filtering, circumvention, and distributed denial of service attacks against independent media. He's the co-author of a new report, Partisanship, Propaganda, and Disinformation, Online Media, and the 2016 U.S. Presidential Election. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into Robert Mercer and Stephen Bannon's role in flooding social media with fake news, possibly in collusion with the Russians.
From Russia with love. I fly to you, much wiser since my goodbye to you.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Frank Pasquale, who's a professor of law at the University of Maryland, whose research addresses the challenges posed to information law by rapidly changing technology. He is a visiting fellow at Princeton Center for Information Technology and serves on the advisory boards of the Data Competition Institute, Patient Privacy Rights, and the Electronic Privacy Information Center. And he's the author of The Black Box Society, The Secret Algorithms That Control Money and Information. Welcome to Background Briefing, Frank Pasquale.
Thank you.
And Frank, what do you make of these revelations now that Russians bought at least 100,000, maybe more, dollars worth of ads during the campaign on Facebook, and Facebook's had to sort of face up to it? Zuckerberg's been reluctant to talk about how much Facebook, since what, 3/4 of the Americans get their information from Facebook, how much the Republicans, particularly Bannon and company, used Facebook to spread fake news. But now it looks as though the Russians were actively involved as well. And I imagine people are looking at the links between coordination, since the Russians appeared to be acting on Trump's behalf, whether they were doing voluntarily or in coordination with the campaign, I think is a burning question, is it not?
Yes, I mean, I think there's a lot of really critical issues here that are exposing Facebook's irresponsibility and the complete and antiquated nature of our campaign finance laws, because with television ads, we get to know, we get disclosure. Here, there are all of these dark ads, there's the secret data, secret algorithms that are generating this effort to manipulate the public. It's deeply troubling.
And I think you have to go back, don't you, to the Republican assault on Facebook, where they suggested that the human curation of their news was biased, and Zuckerberg, in response, got rid of the human curators and went to algorithms, and it seems as though Bannon and Mercer and company were ready with fake news to game these algorithms. So I've never understood why people don't see that obvious connection. It seemed like a typical kind of Mau Mau attack on Facebook designed to get them to yield, they got the results by getting rid of the human curation of their news.
Yeah, so I mean, I think that the key issue here is that you need human curation, that the algorithms are primitive. The companies involved try to characterize them as almost being human level or being incredible advances in artificial intelligence technology. But as we can see here, they can be relatively easily manipulated by very bad actors. When you cut the humans out of the loop, you should expect manipulation. And I think that was a huge problem. And you're absolutely right that that type of attack, which was based on very lightly sourced information, that article that came out on that, you know, was an example of the ability of, I think, you know, very, very wealthy actors to manipulate the public sphere.
And it's, in the first place, it's bad enough that Facebook has that kind of influence, right? That, what, 2/3 to 3/4 of Americans get their news via Facebook, and it tends to be siloed amongst their friends who are like-minded. And that in itself is a major problem, is it not?
So the critical problem here is that we have an automated public sphere. We used to have many more institutions that were more powerful, that could impose basic standards of truthfulness, newsworthiness, and non-bias. And I think that the issue here is that we, because of the filter bubble problem that you mentioned, you're getting people who are in environments where they're never being challenged and where even the most propagandistic or false information can simply flow directly to them without any responsible intermediary.
Well, it's not as if people have been warning Facebook. I mean, Clinton Watts, who gave testimony to the House and Senate committees, a former FBI agent who's tracked Russian activity online with their troll farms and bots, etc., he'd been pointing this out for some time, as others have. What's your understanding of Robert Mercer's role here, since it seems difficult not to connect Mercer, Cambridge Analytica, Bannon, who's served on the board, and their obviously skillful use of social media and micro-targeting, as opposed to Hillary Clinton's blanket TV advertising. I mean, in politics, the race goes to the swiftest, so if they won fair and square, that's one thing, but it doesn't sound like they won fair and square.
Well, I think that both sides did have sophisticated digital operations. I do think, though, that there was probably, to the extent that, say, the Trump side had very good access to extremely micro-targeted and innovative methods of finding persuadable voters, or, even more importantly, finding ways to discourage Clinton voters from coming out, that may have given the advantage to them. And, you know, I'm not one of these folks who believes that you can create a completely level electoral playing field. I think there's always going to be a lot of difficulty in terms of, you know, the fight is very hard to make a fair fight, but what we can at least expect is having some level of disclosure, understanding of where money is entering the election, how it's influencing us before we vote. And if we don't have that, then fundamental democratic processes are being undermined.
And again, I'm speaking with Frank Pasquale. He's a professor of law at the University of Maryland, whose research addresses the challenges posed to information law by rapidly changing technology. He is a visiting fellow at Princeton Center for Information Technology and serves on the advisory boards of the Data Competition Institute, Patient Privacy Rights, and the Electronic Privacy Information Center. And he's the author of The Black Box Society, The Secret Algorithms That Control Money and Information. So what do you think is going on with Facebook in terms of when you've got Senator Warner, the minority chair of the Senate Intelligence Committee, saying that the Russian ad buys on Facebook during the elections to support Donald Trump and hurt Hillary Clinton are just the tip of the iceberg, then presumably there's going to be more damaging information. And I imagine from Facebook's point of view, they don't want the government passing laws and restricting their freedom. That seems to be how Silicon Valley operates. They've got obviously the five biggest companies in terms of market capitalization are Google, Facebook, Amazon, Microsoft, and Apple. So they don't want to be regulated. But at this point, do you think Zuckerberg wants to get out ahead of the possibility of a call by Congress for regulation?
I think that the type of disclosure that Senator Warner is calling for makes a lot of sense, and it's the only way to sort of level the playing field between the sort of online environment and traditional media. And I think that, Zuckerberg and others are worried about that because they have tried to shroud their operations in extreme secrecy. But I don't think they'll be able to do so for much longer because now people are finally beginning to understand exactly how destructive the secrecy can be.
It seems, though, that there are other strands to this story. And just recently, the New York Times did a fairly detailed report on election hacking by Russians, which in part was based upon the leak from Reality Winner, this NSA contractor who's facing a lot of jail time. She leaked an NSA report to The Intercept that indicated that there was quite an active campaign underway. So if you combine all of these things, the Russian ad buying on Facebook, if Senator Warner's right, it's the tip of the iceberg, the electoral interference, which people are only just now looking into, I mean, the Kenyans are having a do-over of an election. At what point do you think America is going to be faced with a prospect that maybe we need to do a do-over?
I am not aware of the Kenyan jurisprudence on electoral do-overs, but I do think that what this decision by the Kenyan court indicates is that democracies have to be much more aware of the stakes when elections are happening, and we have to be more willing to have a stronger regulatory role in assuring basic foundations of transparency and legitimacy in electoral processes. And if we don't have that, we really are in deep trouble as a democracy. And I think that, you know, this is the revelations that you're describing are going to have reverberations for decades in terms of how we think about electoral regulation in the public sphere.
So just to inform the public about the the mechanisms here and how this is done. And obviously, in your book, Frank Pasquale, The Black Box Society, The Secret Algorithms That Control Money and Information, you have delved into this. How do they do this? And why is it that the Russians seem to have these troll farms and be able to harness all these bots? And just describe, if you will, the nature of how these bots act as multipliers and how pernicious they are and how widespread their use is. Because I understand Google uses its own bots to amplify the effects of its advertising. And they were recently sued by, I think, Procter & Gamble, who discovered that they weren't getting their money's worth on advertising.
Well, it is really remarkable in terms of how prevalent these bots are. And people, researchers were noticing even, you know, 5-10 years ago that state actors were starting to use bots to disrupt political movements. So you might have, say, a revolution against the government, and then if that was getting organized via Twitter, the government may spam the hashtag. They may make it very difficult for people to organize by having lots of bots or put in fake posts. And so, yeah, this is something that, you know, has been a concern of long standing, and the U.S. Department of Defense has even published studies about the use of information warfare using bots to sort of impersonate different actors and to create strategic misunderstandings. I think that what we never expected was it happening so soon to the United States.
And specifically, how does that multiplying effect work? Because my understanding is that they sort of harness thousands of computers as though they, somebody I think referred to them as zombies, that they somehow can use passive computers without anybody knowing that they are being harnessed by a foreign actor?
That's right, because if you get a certain level of distribution of malware, viruses, botnets, now the Internet of Things enables different types of strategies there. You can essentially hijack lots of machines, send out messages where it's very hard to determine the provenance, the ultimate originator of all of this type of disruptive attacking behavior. And so that is a big issue. And, you know, one of the other things that comes up is, you know, if you've got state actors that have very large budgets, that creates a multiplier effect. Another multiplier effect is that you can, given tax havenry and the spread of secrecy jurisdictions, you might have money spread around the world in offshore bank accounts that can in turn be, you know, sent around to evade different types of money laundering laws or other types of laws that would, say, keep it out of the hands of bad actors. So the multiplier effect is real, and it's very problematic.
Do you think, though, that the U.S., my expectation would be the U.S. has similar, if not superior, capabilities to the Russians? Is it just a question of not pulling the trigger? What's your understanding on that?
Well, I do think that there's probably some information about different ways in which the U.S. government has manipulated foreign elections or manipulated different public spheres. I haven't studied that. I'm not terribly privy to that type of information. But I do think that, you know, you are right to raise the possibility that eventually you're going to see the U.S. government trying to take revenge or, in otherwise, you know, make up for what has been done to it by increasing its own use of these types of bots or interference.
Well, Frank Pasquale, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you, Ian. It's been great.
And again, we've been speaking with Frank Pasquale, who is at a noisy railway station. He is a professor of law at the University of Maryland, whose research addresses the challenges posed to information law by rapidly changing technology. He's a visiting fellow at Princeton Center for Information Technology and serves on the advisory boards of the Data Completion Institute, the Patient Privacy Rights, and the Electronic Privacy Information Center. And he's the author of The Black Box Society, The Secret Algorithms That Control Money and Information. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back trying to make sense of the Oval Office about-face that stunned Republican leaders as President Trump suddenly embraced his new political allies, Chuck and Nancy. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Lawrence Jacobs, who is the Walter F. and Joan Mondale Chair of Political Science at the University of Minnesota, where he also directs the Center for the Study of Politics and Governance at the Hubert H. Humphrey School of Political Affairs. His books include Talking Together, Public Deliberation in America, and The Search for Community, and Class War, Economic Inequality, and the American Dream. And his latest book is Fed Power, How Finance Wins. Welcome to Background Briefing, Lawrence Jacobs.
Good to be back with you.
Well, thank you, Lawrence. And can you make sense of what happened yesterday in the Oval Office, where Donald Trump suddenly agreed to with Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer, otherwise known as Nancy and Chuck? he agreed after they had made their pitch and the Republicans had made their pitch first. And then without even any art of the deal negotiating, Trump sided with the Democrats against his own party, leaving Paul Ryan and Mitch McConnell absolutely stunned. And then today, Donald Trump's calling Chuck Schumer and Nancy Pelosi up on the phone and talking about what great television coverage he's been getting and how wonderful it all is because of his new relationship with the Democrats, who hitherto now he's never even spoken with or even counted on. So what's going on?
Well, I think it's a combination of several things. One is that Donald Trump has yet to learn the art of legislating. And one of the cardinal rules is that you have to work as a team, and particularly with your party. So his treatment of Mitch McConnell and Congressman Ryan, both the Republican leaders, is absolutely unprecedented. It's got everybody who follows politics in Washington just baffled. I've never seen anything quite like it. You really rely on your party in Congress as your core team, and Trump has just, dealt them a quite embarrassing surprise. On the other hand, there is a reality that Donald Trump is responding to and that he's experienced over the last 7 months, which is it's very difficult to pass anything in Congress of import if you don't have some kind of bipartisan majority. And Donald Trump knew that he was not going to pass the emergency aid for Harvey and probably the emergency aid that's going to be needed for the Irma hurricane about to hit Florida if he didn't have the Democrats on board. So he cut the deal. He just did it in a very awkward, unprecedented sort of way in which he really surprised and undermined his own Republican colleagues.
Well, the Republicans first offered an 18-month extension on the debt limit, and then the Democrats countered with 3 months, and he quickly accepted that. Now, my understanding is that it's a little hard to follow for the layperson here what the politics of this kind of brinkmanship and cliffhanging and threatening to shut down the government and the debt ceiling involve. But in simple terms, is it the fact that the Republicans have an inherent problem with their own Freedom Caucus, the Tea Party, who habitually threaten to shut down the government? So what this deal has done to the Republicans is taken away that leverage to threaten to shut down the government. How would you describe what happened?
You're absolutely right that the negotiating is over the terms of the debt limit. That's the key part. And for Republicans, they don't want to have this vote very often because it splits their caucus. You're going to have in the House a battle between the kind of ultra-conservative Libertarian Freedom Caucus who do not want to raise the debt unless it comes with punishing deficit programs, and a more realistic, pragmatic wing of the Republican Party that is recognizes that needs to pass emergency aid, and they need to do it with Democrats on board to get it through the Senate, where you need 60 votes. So that's where things are, and what the Democrats have just done with Donald Trump is to guarantee that there are now going to be multiple votes on the thing that Democratic leaders most want to happen to the Republicans, which is divisive debates that pull apart the Republican Party. That is good news for Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer because it paralyzed the Republican Party. Very bad news for Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell and the Speaker Paul Ryan.
And again, I'm speaking with Lawrence Jacobs, who is the Walter F. and Joan Mondale Chair of Political Science at the University of Minnesota, where he also directs the Center for the Study of Politics and Governance at the Hubert H. Humphrey School of Political Affairs. His books include Talking Together, Public Deliberation in America and the Search for Community, and Class War, Economic Inequality and the American Dream. And his latest book is Fed Power, How Finance Wins. So this is odd, though, isn't it, in the overall critique that you're hearing about the Republicans, mostly from Democrats, who are saying that they're not standing up to Trump, particularly acute after Trump was made all those overtures to the Nazis in Charlottesville. But a few Republicans, for example, there's Senator Corker, the chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, has questioned Trump's stability and competence. Then former Senator John Danforth called upon his Republican colleagues in the Senate to save the GOP from, quote, this hateful man. So what's going on here in terms of that contradiction? On the one hand, you've got a situation where people are saying that the Republicans are not standing up to Trump. And on the other hand, they're just basically being punished by him and insulted by him. And he's calling Ryan and McConnell all kinds of horrible names, and now he's really stiffed them with making a deal with the Democrats, but yet they're sticking with him. So go figure.
Yeah, I think you've put it well. I think there's clearly erratic behavior here by President Trump. I don't think we've had a modern president who's been as inexplicable and self-destructive in his behavior. Here you've got another case, which is quite different. I give the president credit that he's found yet another peculiar pattern to pursue. That is, in this case, he's betraying Republicans, who I suspect he's punishing. He's had a summer-long battle in which he's been insulting Mitch McConnell and other Republican leaders. And this may be, you know, Donald Trump's way of kind of smacking them, which he likes to do. But again, it doesn't help him. He's now going to be splitting the Republican Party. He's further alienating the Republican leadership. And then, you know, come December and the early part of 2018, Republicans are going to be at each other's throats because they're going to have to vote again on lifting the debt ceiling. So none of this is good for Donald Trump at the end of the day, and it's very bad for the Republican Party. Just to pull back, the big picture here is the Republican Party has yet to achieve any major legislative accomplishment. It failed in the repeal of Obamacare. It's at risk of failing to do tax cuts. It's now facing a ticking time bomb on its budgets. It's got a temporary extension to December. But, you know, the big dreams that the Republicans had coming in, really the only thing you can point to is the confirmation of Neil Gorsuch to the Supreme Court. Everything else has been a wipeout. And this latest behavior by Donald Trump, you know, makes it even more difficult. The Republicans are going to rally. One final complication here. By the time the calendar strikes 2018, you're going to see a very different set of calculations in Congress because the midterm elections will be approaching, and there's quite a bit of trepidation among Republicans that the president's record unpopularity will be an albatross for them as they head into midterm year. So it's all in all a terrible situation for Republicans.
So tonight, Thursday night, the president is having a private dinner at the White House with the Speaker of the House, Paul Ryan. So is he going to pivot again? I mean, that's either going to be a pretty frosty meal, or what's the purpose here, do you think, after humiliating him yesterday? Apparently, the person he really humiliated was his Treasury Secretary, Steven Mnuchin, who was in the middle of pitching why they needed this 18 months extension of the debt ceiling, and he was in the middle of making his pitch when Trump just shut him up, cut him off at the knees. So what do you think is going to happen tonight over dinner between President Trump and Speaker Ryan?
There's a very interesting split-level reality. There's Donald Trump, who is clearly someone who is erratic. He doesn't follow the rules of politics or necessarily political logic, and repeatedly is hurting himself and his party. That's the reality I think just about everybody sees now. But in the White House, his staff, and particularly those who have worked in Washington, are hard at work trying to create some kind of working relationship with Republican congressional leaders. And my hunch is that this dinner between the president and Paul Ryan was put together by the senior Trump staff as part of this effort to get the president spending some time building up relationship with the Republican leadership in Congress.
So you wouldn't then suggest that this is any kind of sea change, what happened yesterday in the Oval Office, where suddenly Chuck and Nancy were Trump's favorites?
No. I think, the interests are at odds. And, Chuck Schumer and Nancy Pelosi have their own political agenda here. And it's to damage the Republican Party and to make sure Donald Trump is a one-term president. So there's nothing here that's really going to be sustainable. And I imagine that, there'll be a point, maybe not in the too distant future, where Donald Trump will lash out at them.
Well, Nancy Pelosi's actually, along with Donald Trump, calling up Pelosi and Chuck Schumer today to talk about how pleased he is with the press coverage that he's getting. And that's what's so strange about this president. He spends so much time watching television to see how he's being reviewed as opposed to doing the job in the first place. But apparently he agreed that Pelosi had asked him to do something about, or to make some reassurances about DACA, the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrival Program. And Trump went ahead and did that. And now Pelosi's bragging about how Trump basically did what she told him to do. Quoting her, "I was telling my colleagues this is what I asked the president to do, and boom, 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 the tweet appeared." So it's all a bit strange, isn't it?
It's strange, but again, I don't think DACA is going to be passed by Republican Congress. It couldn't be passed when you had a Democratic majority. It's very divisive, and almost certainly Speaker Ryan and Majority Leader Mitch McConnell have other issues they want to tackle in the coming 6 months. So I don't think there's much hope of that. And I think this little brief interlude of Trump with the Democrats will be short-lived.
Well, in the broader sense, though, when you've got people, as I mentioned, Senator Corker questioning Trump's stability and competence, as much as this appears to be strange, and he's always whipsawing everybody all the time, and he certainly gets a lot of attention simply because people are just sort of almost fascinated by this almost never-ending train wreck. But it gets real serious, doesn't it, when you've got the possibility of nuclear war with North Korea?
Yes, I think that is the most serious issue that we're facing. I would say, in fairness to the Trump administration, we've had a series of presidents going back to the 1980s who have been trying to contain a increasingly explosive and unstable North Korea. The crisis that the Trump administration is facing is not of its own making, and it's really staring at some very disturbing possibilities and some very real threats. And it's the North Koreans who built an intercontinental missile and have apparently well along in miniaturizing a nuclear warhead. Now, that's not Trump's creation. Whether he's handling it right or not, and whether the kind of verbal jousting he's engaged in is helpful, probably not. But the alternative, which has been the diplomatic route, has clearly not worked for, you know, the last four presidents. So I'm a little more sympathetic on that issue. I think it's just a god-awful mess. And I think there's a great peril there.
Well, if there's another missile launched, then I'm pretty sure that the U.S. will try to shoot it down, and then it'll be a question of whether or not these expensive systems work. But I can't see any American president allowing a missile to head towards the United States or even towards Guam. So then the question arises about, you know, the war. We've had all these debates about the War Powers Act. Congress doesn't have a role when it comes to the commander-in-chief pressing the nuclear button. It is a system that's entirely in the hands of the president, and there's very little time involved in any advice from anybody, except, you know, I think the person in the chain of command, of course, being the Secretary of Defense, since the early warning system comes through the Secretary of Defense. But is there any way that we can get some assurances that that this president of ours is up to the task of handling this extraordinary responsibility? After all, he could destroy the fate of the world is at his fingertips.
No, I mean, I think the test of that was Election Day. If you're looking for any hope or solace, it would be that President Trump is surrounded by three pretty experienced generals. He's got his chief of staff, the national security advisor, and the secretary of defense, three generals, all quite familiar with our military system and nuclear capabilities. I'm personally not enthusiastic about civilian leadership deferring to generals, but I think given Donald Trump's unfamiliarity with national security policy, that's kind of where we are.
Well, Lawrence Jacobs, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Okay, good to be with you.
Thank you.
Take care.
You too. And again, I've been speaking with Lawrence Jacobs, who is the Walter F. and Joan Mondale Chair for Political Science at the University of Minnesota, where he also directs the Center for the Study of Politics and Governance at the Hubert H. Humphrey School of Political Affairs. His books include Talking Together, Public Deliberation in America and the Search for Community, and Class War, Economic Inequality and the American Dream. And his latest book is Fed Power, How Finance Wins. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.